This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
They kind of put us on this boat. I was 7 and my brother was 6. Set out. Incredibly dangerous voyage, actually. We were shipwrecked, as I kind of tell in the story, shipwrecked about 6 months in, and I almost died. In fact, the whole boat almost sank.
That is today's guest, Suzanne Haywood. At 7 years old, she embarked on a sailing expedition with her family, recreating Captain Cook's perilous third voyage around the world. The idea was the brainchild of her father. The trip, it was supposed to last 3 years. It ended up taking 10. She has a memoir out called Wave Walker Breaking Free, where she shares her experience growing up for a decade at sea, unable to attend a normal school, surviving a shipwreck, and eventually making it back to the UK and to university. You're going to hear her captivating story of resilience on the show today. So let's get into it. Buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here. And welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, it's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show, my friend. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. And of course, on this show, we talk a lot about the benefits of travel. But what happens when one person's dream adventure is forced onto their travel companions in a way that is not healthy? It's not sustainable. And that's what today's episode is about. In many ways, it's a cautionary tale, perhaps an extreme example, but I think it provides some food for thought that there are benefits to this sort of travel. But Suzanne shares her story and where it went wrong for her. And I think this story is really a reminder of the importance of considering the needs of your travel companions, especially when they are children. And Suzanne, you can read more about her on her website. Of course, the memoir, Wave Walker, Breaking Free. Stick around on the back end of this conversation. I want to touch on this comment Suzanne shared in the interview.
You know, you can make a huge difference in somebody's life through what might seem to you to be a small intervention.
And I'll also leave you with a quote that I think exemplifies one of the big themes of this particular episode. Stick around for all that. One last thing, ZeroToTravel.com/newsletter. We're planning community trips. I'm sharing travel tips. I'm shaking my hips. Sharing quips. I don't know. I couldn't think of any more rhymes. But if you go over there, ZeroToTravel.com/newsletter, you can sign up for our free newsletter, which goes out once a week. And you can keep in touch over there off the pod. Now, it's time to get into this conversation, which contains so many incredible details. You're not going to believe it. It's one thing to get the overview of this story. It's another to hear the particulars of what happened, how things went down, how she was feeling. And you're going to hear it right now. So please enjoy my conversation with Suzanne. And I will see you on the other side, my friend. Cheers. How are you doing today?
I'm good. Actually, I wasn't feeling so well yesterday. I just took my kids on holiday to India. We all came back with some sort of bug. So yesterday I was feeling definitely under the weather, but feeling much better today.
How long was that trip?
Just for kind of a week, 10 days, which was great. But I've got 3 kids. 2 of them have never been to India before. And I kind of feel it's one of those places you just have to go to experience it.
Never been. I have to get to India. How old are the kids now?
They're now 22, 20, and 20.
Okay. Yeah. So they're not like, it's not like traveling with toddlers.
No. Although I've always kind of traveled with them. I mean, I kind of, maybe one of the kind of legacies of my childhood is I've always liked kind of traveling. So they've done a lot of traveling, but they India, no. Well, they'd been to Sri Lanka and Japan, but not India. Somehow India is harder work, I have to say.
I've heard that. Yeah, did you get to learn anything new by seeing it through their eyes, as them seeing it from a fresh perspective, having that experience the first time there?
I think it was really interesting how shocked they were by, you know, because I remember going I went backpacking there when I was a teenager. And so I kind of knew what it was like, but they just haven't been somewhere quite like that. I mean, they have been to other places. They've been to, as I say, Sri Lanka, and we went to Cuba at one point during the period where it opened up before it kind of closed down again. It was that kind of brief opening. So they have seen some fairly kind of interesting places, but still, India is incredible. It's going to be such an interesting economy, the largest democracy in the world. But it's total chaos. I mean, it really just feels completely chaotic when you're there. Yeah.
I mean, it sounds like the choice to go, because you could have gone other places. Was that pretty intentional to kind of expose them to something radically different from the UK?
Yeah. I mean, as I say, I like traveling. So, and my kids are happy to come with me so long as I'm paying. I think they kind of see this. So I get a little bit of control over where we go. So I do use it a little bit to try and kind of take them to the slightly non-obvious places.
You kind of had to learn to like traveling in some regard. We should kind of mention your memoir here, of course, Wave Walker, Breaking Free. And this is describing how you grew up for a decade at sea, unable to attend normal school, surviving a shipwreck, and eventually making it back to the UK and to university. It's the short version of that, but we're going to go deeper today. I should formally say, Suzanne Haywood, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend. We haven't formally welcomed you yet. Yeah, thanks for coming on and agreeing to talk about this. You know, reading the beginning of the book and hearing it from your perspective, at that time you were you six or seven? I can't remember.
So I was six when my father suddenly announced that he wanted to sail around the world on Wave Walker to kind of recreate Captain Cook's third voyage around the world. I was seven when we set sail. And the promise at the time was we were going to go for 3 years and I was going to be back by the time I was 10 and everything was going to go back to normal. I was going to go back to going to school and kind of find my dog again, Rusty, and all my kind of friends. So this was going to be a 3-year adventure and then come back.
Which is still a lot to wrap your head around. I mean, it's interesting because as I was reading it, my daughter is seven right now. And so I'm thinking about all of this and trying to process, as you have had to do through writing this memoir and through just living life and going through these experiences, which some of them are so intense. An article you wrote about the memoir caught my eye because, you know, on this show and just travel media in general, I mean, I try to give as many perspectives as possible. And I think, like, you know, when somebody sees on the surface, oh, you know, a family took their kids to sail around the world. And this is like, what kid's so lucky to do that? And this is the greatest gift you could give a kid. And not many people have that opportunity and all that kind of stuff. And so it can be idealized in a way. You know, your story shows that that's not necessarily what the kids are thinking, that that's the best thing for them. And, you know, this might be an extreme example, but I think one of the things we talked about going into this chat is that, like you mentioned in your email, there's a way to travel with kids in a way that respects their needs and the parents' dream. I just think this is a fascinating story. And also we can kind of pull out some of those lessons, I'm sure. But was it like that for you? Did it feel like you had to learn to like travel? Or was it, I mean, it's hard to leave everything behind at 7 years old, your dog and your house and everything you know and your school. You don't really know much about the world and what you're getting into. So putting yourself back in your shoes at that point, how were you feeling when you first heard about it?
I mean, at the time, I had really mixed emotions. And I remember it very well because there's a kind of before and after in my life, you know, kind of before 7 years old and after 7 years old. And I was really upset about leaving. As I said, the kind of three things that really got to me were leaving my best friend, Sarah, you know, leaving my dog, Rusty, that I was very attached to, and leaving my doll's house. I'd just been given a doll's house for Christmas. That wasn't allowed on board. So I could take almost nothing on board. I took a small teddy bear. I remember I took my favorite dress, and that was pretty much it. We had almost no toys on board or anything. And one of the reasons why I wrote the book is exactly as you say, there is this huge romanticism about taking kids on extreme adventures. And what I found is most of these accounts are written by the parents, not by the kids. And I do think there's a way to do it that respects kids' needs. But I think parents need to accept, and it might be a little bit hard to accept, but kids like normality. You know, they want to be kind of normal. I'm afraid kind of kids are a little bit boring. They want to have friends, not kind of play dates, you know, not meeting another kid on a boat or on a trek for a day. They actually want friendships. They want stability. Now, that doesn't mean you can't travel with kids. You can, but you've got to respect what a kid needs. And what my parents never seemed to kind of pause and think about was what were our needs. They kind of put us on this boat. I was seven and my brother was six. Set out, incredibly dangerous voyage, actually. We were shipwrecked, as I kind of tell in the story, shipwrecked about 6 months in, and I almost died. In fact, the whole boat almost sank. So, you know, there's a way to do this that respects kids' needs, both for kind of physical safety and everything else. And there's a way not to do that. And I do think we over-romanticize taking kids on these extreme journeys. And I think it's about time that the kids' voice starts to get heard. And by the way, it's really interesting. Since the book came out, about 30 kids have reached out to me who've all come from, they've all come from extreme travel backgrounds. A lot of them, as you might imagine, are sailors or ex-sailors. But not just, you know, there's kind of somebody who grew up being dragged across America on a kind of extreme cycle ride. There's a couple of homeschoolers. And they're all saying the same thing, which is the voice of the kids is not being heard here. And we need to balance the needs of the kids with the needs of the parents.
Do you know anything about your dad's childhood?
Yeah, so my dad had a really tough childhood. And I think this is part of what played into it. He grew up in a mining village in the UK. A little town called Thurcroft near Doncaster, which was a mining village. His father was a miner. I think his father was a very tough, quite kind of violent man. He died quite early, sadly, of lung cancer. So my dad had a really difficult childhood. He ended up running away from home to work in a butcher's shop to basically pay for his way through secondary school, because his father wanted to send him down the mine. So partly, I think one of the reasons why my father just couldn't get why he should even be concerned about his kids' needs was his childhood had been so much more difficult. So compared to his, I guess ours felt better in a funny sort of way. The other thing, which I think kind of comes out of the story, is my father had a massive chip on his shoulder about presenting to the world a kind of image of being this kind of perfect family. You know, we were living on this beautiful boat, we were sailing around the world. You know, he wanted everyone to admire us and particularly him. But the reality behind that facade was that we were incredibly poor. You know, we were often in quite a lot of physical danger. I think I only saw a doctor once or twice in 10 years. I never saw a dentist. We were often hungry. But that was the, you know, but that was all kind of hidden inside this facade, which my father was very keen to preserve, which I think is partly due to the very difficult background that he'd escaped from.
So kind of crafting this image around the sort of the classic English explorer off doing something that nobody else will do. But in the meantime, he's got his family with him and there's been no conversation about if it's something you guys want to do or not. Yeah, I mean, you can see how he might have, yeah, just been like, well, it was, you know, it was way harder for me. So what are you complaining about type of attitude? I don't know if he was straightforward with that or if that was just in his head. Do you think it was sort of also like a subconscious thing where it's like, I had it hard and that's how I learned about the world. So that's how my kids should learn about the world too, is by putting them through the ringer, so to speak.
So he never said it explicitly. So this is me kind of putting two and two together and understanding a little bit about his childhood. What was really clear, although he never said it, but it was very clear through his actions, was he had this huge desire to be seen by the world as a hero. And travel, I think, particularly extreme travel, is a way of, you know, trying to demonstrate to the world that you're somehow, you know, somebody to be admired. You're doing something very extreme. In his case, he wanted to sail around the world following Captain Cook, sailing the wrong way around the world. And I should explain what I mean by that is most people who sail around the world, they sail from east to west, somewhere near the equator. And that means that you have the wind behind you and actually the sea's not too rough by and large. But my father, because we were following Captain Cook's third voyage, which was the pretext for our whole voyage, I should say my maiden name is Cook, although there's no relation as far as I know, but it was a great way to earn money, to raise money for this voyage. And we weren't an incredibly wealthy family, so he needed to raise money for this voyage. So we were following Captain Cook's third voyage. He went the wrong way. He actually sailed from west to east around the world because he was going in search of a potential northwest passage around the top of North America. And that meant to catch the wind, you needed to go incredibly far south, which meant sailing across the southern Atlantic Ocean and then sailing across the southern Indian Ocean. And those are two of the most dangerous oceans in the world to cross. And talking to other sailors, they are, you know, generally pretty horrified that anyone would attempt to do that on a little sailing boat with almost no communication devices on board, and doubly horrified by the idea that you would then take a 7- and a 6-year-old on that voyage. And we were very badly shipwrecked on the second leg. But to some extent, my dad reveled in this because this was a tale that he was telling of being a hero. He was following Captain Cook. He was kind of reliving Captain Cook's memory. He was doing a kind of good and noble thing. This was how it was always presented to me and my brother and my mother. And the danger was slightly by the by.
I mean, I know you wrote about it and everything like that, but that doesn't mean that this is easy. I mean, I'm sure every time you talk about this and now you're promoting a book. And I mean, how's that been for you? Just putting the book out, but also now having these conversations and kind of revisiting a lot of these experiences. Has it been hard?
In a funny sort of way, it's been incredibly liberating. I've spent my whole life in fear to some extent of telling the truth about my childhood because my parents always had their version of this story, which was my father was a hero. It was an incredible adventure, and it all worked out anyway, because I did eventually escape and get myself to university, despite quite a lot of resistance from my parents. I always knew that that story wasn't true, or at least it was only very, very partially true. But I never really felt that I could tell the right story, because I knew that if I did, I would blow up the remaining relationship that I had with my parents, which was a very superficial relationship, but they're still my parents. And you also,
you also feel
this huge social obligation to have a relationship with your parents, even if they haven't been great parents to you. Eventually, I got to the point where I had kids of my own of a similar sort of age to what I had been when I'd really suffered on Wave Walker. And I looked at them through the eyes of a parent and I thought, I just can't justify some of the decisions that my parents made at the same age for me. And actually, I'm now willing to risk this relationship with my parents in order to tell the truth. Now, I didn't want to lose my relationship with my parents, but I knew it was very likely because they're not the sort of people who would ever tolerate any sort of criticism, even, you know, even minor criticism. And their reaction to the book when it kind of came out, in fact, well before it came out, was even more extreme than I expected. I mean, they've kind of walked away from me and abandoned me multiple times in my life. They did in New Zealand, as I describe in the book, and they disowned me when I was at university, and my father last walked out on me in kind of 2019. But what's really interesting is I feel completely liberated because I've now told the story as I experienced it, as kind of honestly as I could. And it's a bit like people describe kind of coming out about, you know, a secret part of their life. I mean, it's now kind of out there and I feel very comfortable with it. And I'm no longer trying to kind of dance this line between preserving this myth of it being just a wonderful adventure and the reality of what I experienced.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So by taking a hard stance and kind of just taking ownership of the experience and basically like eliminating the narrative and saying this is the truth of what happened, and whatever may be when it comes to me sharing it. Yeah, I can see that that would feel liberating. And I mean, it's courageous of you. They're, like you said, they're still your parents. So I guess at this point, you don't have, really don't have a relationship with them in that way, because they're just too bent about the way you're sharing it.
No, my mother passed away in 2016 and kind of left a very unpleasant letter for me, which I mention at the back of the book, where she basically threatened that if I wrote my book, she would try to destroy my husband's career. And my husband was very senior in the UK government at the time. Sadly, he's now passed away, so I'm a widow. And my father walked out on me and my kids after I was widowed in 2019, after demanding that I should not publish my book. So I have now lost my relationship with my father. I've written to him, so this is his decision, not mine. And I feel quite sad about it from his point of view, because he's lost not only the relationship with me, but also with three of his grandchildren. On the other hand, I'm incredibly supported by my three kids, who've been very supportive all the way through this, and my broader family. In fact, two of members of my broader family have written to me and have said that they really wish they'd known what it was like to be on Wave Walker. And they kind of wish in retrospect that they had done something. But what do you do when somebody puts his wife and two kids on a boat and sets sail? Well, you know, what do you do? It's very hard. I mean, I don't blame them at all. I mean, how... and of course, this is all in the blaze of publicity and people saying this is a wonderful extreme travel and, you know, he's a hero and all of this. It's very hard for anybody to do anything.
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions. Towing capacity varies by configuration. See Nissan Towing Guide and Owner's Manual for additional information. Always secure cargo. Now, back to the show. Yeah, I mean, in many ways, I can imagine this book is a I mean, you sharing the experience is a reckoning for him, because it sort of strips away all of the things that he presents himself to be. It takes it away. If you're not willing to look at it honestly, it's, I don't know.
So I should say that my father, in many ways, is an incredible person. I mean, he managed to, when we set sail from England, he didn't even know kind of properly how to navigate. He taught himself how to navigate. He became an extremely proficient sailor. He was a risk taker. So he would do things that, when I now look at it with a much more kind of mature set of eyes, I now realize he was a kind of repeated risk taker. He put us often into very dangerous situations, but he was a very competent sailor. And he was able to kind of turn his hands to doing almost anything, from fixing an engine to kind of building a mast at one point, sorting stuff out. So a very, you know, in many ways, he has many, many kind of admirable qualities. I think if he decided to do this on his own, and then my mother and my brother and I had gone to meet him, or if we'd kind of gone to join him, for this would have been a very, very different story. For me, and that's why the book is interesting, for me, the decision was to load two small kids on the boat and then to take us for a decade on the boat with no real provision for kind of schooling or friendships or, and as I say, a whole series of decisions made to make this a very dangerous journey. And with my mother, who hated sailing, who got very, very badly seasick. So she was very unhappy on the boat, and she kind of took that out particularly on me. As I became older, our kind of relationship deteriorated, and we're all kind of trapped on this boat for year after year after year. So in many ways, he is a bit of a hero. You know, he's a kind of flawed hero, but he has many admirable characteristics. But he had no ability to really step back and think about what the implications were of all of these decisions for the family that he dragged along with him on this adventure.
Yeah. I mean, it came to a head pretty quick with the, in terms of the dangerous situations. You mentioned 6 months in being shipwrecked and reading that account and hearing what happened. I mean, you can share it here, but, you know, of course, thinking about my daughter, who was the same age as you were at the time that that happened, her little body being thrown around in that way. It's just, yeah, it's so hard. It's hard to hear. Can you talk about that experience? Because that sounds like that was one of the more transformative, maybe that's the wrong word, but one of the bigger experiences in your life that sticks with you.
Yeah, and it was a defining moment because it then influenced everything that happened afterwards. So what happened was we left South, we had this terrible crossing from South America to South Africa across the Southern Indian Ocean. We managed to make it to South Africa, despite the fact that we'd lost our compass partway across that voyage. Then we set sail from South Africa to Australia, the most dangerous ocean in the world, the Southern Indian Ocean, which is known to be incredibly dangerous. We only had two novice crew on board at that point in time. My father, unfortunately, my parents tended to fall out with people quite a lot. I think to be the sort of person who does this sort of voyage, you really only want things to be done your own way. So they repeatedly would fall out with people. But one of the bad consequences of that was that we ended up having novice crew on board a lot of the time because my father preferred that because then he could tell them what to do. So we set out from South Africa. It was my mother who gets terribly seasick and doesn't like sailing. It was me. I was still 7 years old. My brother, who was six. These two novice crew members and my father sailing across the Southern Indian Ocean. And we sailed almost immediately into a terrible storm that went on for day after day after day. And what happened was the waves became bigger and bigger and bigger. And the problem in the Southern Indian Ocean is there's no big landmass down there to break up the waves. So they just become bigger and bigger. And it got to the point where we had all the sails down and my father was trying to effectively surf down these 30, 40 foot waves, trying to keep the boat perpendicular so it wouldn't flip over. And I'm trapped down below as a 7 year old. I can't come up on deck. And so what's quite interesting is I'm writing this account from the perspective of a small child trapped down below, because most of these accounts are always told by the sailor, you know, up on deck, fighting the elements. I'm down below. It's like being on a kind of roller coaster. You're incredibly frightened, but you can't do anything. You have no autonomy in this situation whatsoever. And then what happened was the wind mixed around, the waves kind of combined, and we were hit by an enormous wave, several waves probably combined together. My father looked behind himself and saw a wave that was, he estimated, you know, about 1.5 times as high as our main mast, which was 60 foot high, so 90 foot. And it curled over the boat, smashed through the middle of the deck and out through the side of the boat, causing a huge hole, knocking the boat onto one side. My father was thrown overboard on his lifeline and then flung back onto the boom and broke multiple ribs. But I was the most badly injured. I was standing in the galley in the kitchen down below. I was flung up. I hit the roof of the cabin. I hit the wall of the cabin and I was knocked unconscious. And I remember coming to, lying underneath the table with kind of water pouring through the ceiling. And of course, you're in a situation where you can't get any medical help. It turned out I had a fractured skull. I had a massive blood clot on the brain, which got bigger and bigger and bigger over the following days. But all my parents really did, And possibly all they could have done was they just put me in a bunk and occasionally came and saw me. And my father put a plaster on a cut on my arm. And we were incredibly lucky in a way, because my father guessed where we were. You know, we obviously had no navigation equipment on board apart from a sextant, which is just a device that enables you physically to try and measure the angle between the sun and the horizon. But of course, if you're in a storm, you can't see the sun. We didn't have any satellite navigation or anything like that. So my father guessed where the nearest land was. And there's not much land in the southern Indian Ocean, almost nothing at all. But we were able to find about 3 days later this tiny island called Isle Amsterdam, which has a tiny little French military base on it. And there was a doctor there, and he did multiple operations on my head. But unfortunately, he didn't have any anesthetic that would have worked for head operations. So as a little seven-year-old girl, I ended up having multiple head operations without anesthetic. And that, as you kind of referred to, that became quite a defining thing for me. You know, not only was the wave, as I called it, you know, a defining moment, but also the operations and the fact that I had to go through them on my own because my mother refused to kind of come in. So I then become very afraid of storms and the ocean. Also, of course, at this point, I've slightly lost faith in my father as being the big hero that I thought he was. But my father is determined to keep sailing. And I do describe in the book how I get multiple nightmares about this. I kind of relive it because I'm not allowed to talk about it. You know, one of the things about my parents is you could never talk about things that go wrong. You know, you were not allowed to talk about things that go wrong. So I was never allowed to talk about the wave. Eventually, I figure out a way, though it's many, many years later, to get rid of these nightmares that kind of haunt me for many years after the accident.
How did you do it?
Well, it's interesting. My mother once told me that she had a way of doing something which is, I think it's called lucid dreaming, where you can wake up inside a dream and take control of it. And she described once to me how she did that. And I thought about that. And then I tried to teach myself how to do it. And eventually I figured out, I've now forgotten how to do it again, but eventually as a teenager, I figured out how to do it. I managed to wake myself up in the middle of one of these nightmares. I used to have these nightmares about lying in the cabin where my parents put me and watching the water coming up in the cabin and worrying that the water would get so high that I wouldn't be able to breathe. And things kind of floating past. They were very vivid dreams. And eventually I worked out a way to wake myself up inside those dreams. And then once I've woken myself up inside the dream, I was able to recognize that it was a dream and not reality, and then wake myself up, you know, completely. And once I'd figured out that technique, I was able to take control of those dreams and stop them from happening. But that was many years later. By that point, I was, you know, 13, 14. So we're 6 or 7 years after the accident.
Horrible. What a horrible situation. I mean, and the doctor saved your life essentially, right? With these operations, although no anesthesia at 7 years old, at any age. And you had to go in there alone? That's, oh gosh.
Yeah.
You know, like you said, you have your kids, and then at this age and you're looking at them, isn't it confusing? Like, after, you would think, okay, all right, whatever. Maybe these decisions were made leading up to that. But then something like that happens and then you still sail on for 9 years. I'm sorry. That's confusing. I can't get that.
It is confusing. And I think that's one of the reasons why when I became a parent myself and I had kids of a similar age and I started looking back, I just found it really hard to understand the decisions that had been made. I mean, all of these decisions. I think what was going on is my father, as I say, wanted to be a hero. This was the thing that he had, you know, built his life around, kind of being a hero. And he wasn't going to let even something like that stop him. And, you know, he just convinced himself that, you know, we've been unlucky, but we'd escaped from it. The boat was very badly damaged, so it took some time to repair the boat, and we were just going to continue. And I just don't think he either just couldn't or wouldn't kind of pause to think about what the implications of all of what we've been through were for me and my brother. As little kids, that was just never really considered at all, because he was busy pursuing this dream of being an extreme traveler and taking his kids with him.
How does your brother relate to this experience? It sounded like during, you know, when I was reading in the book in this section about the wave, you know, it's maybe his way of processing it at the time was just, you know, like, oh, you're crying all the time, stop crying. And, you know, he was scared, I'm sure, being the younger brother and being in the situation as well. How does he relate to this experience now? Are you guys on the same page? Has he read your book?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. And I've talked to lots of other kids who've been in very extreme situations. And what seems to happen is if you have two kids who are treated in a similar sort of way and they face a kind of common obstacle, they become very close. You know, they come together to kind of face that. But that actually wasn't what happened with my brother and me. We were actually treated really, really differently on Wave Walker. I'm afraid sailing is quite a gendered world, and that became more and more extreme as I became older. So, for example, my father only had one set of safety life jackets that you could use to work on deck that were child size, and he gave them to my brother. And I was told I had to work down below kind of cooking and cleaning with my mother. My mother had a very different relationship with me than she did with my brother. My brother could do no wrong. He was like a little prince. And I'm afraid I could do no right. I was a bit like kind of Cinderella on the boat. So we had a very different experience. And what happened as a result of that is, you know, we separated. So we didn't really fight. We just kind of kept apart from each other because I knew that if I ever ended up in a conflict with my brother, I would be punished and he would not be punished. And he had a more enjoyable experience because he wasn't really expected to work very much on the boat. As I say, he very rarely got in trouble, whereas I was expected to kind of work down below, kind of cooking and cleaning. And that became more and more extreme over time because what happened was we ran out of money completely. I mean, we lost a lot of the money repairing the boat. But then as time went on, we had no money at all. And my father started taking paying crew on the boat. So he kind of turned Wave Walker into a bit of a hotel. But these crew who were coming on board, who were all novices, were coming on board for holidays. They all had to be catered for. And I was expected to do that, kind of working for several hours each day, which my brother was not expected to do. So the result of which is, you know, my brother remained very, you know, was very close to my parents and remained very close to my parents. Kind of my family separated into my mother, my father, my brother, and me as the kind of black sheep, as it were, who was the kind of disliked child. I don't think that's unique, by the way, unfortunately. I've now talked to many other people who have grown up in a circumstance where there's a favored child and an unfavored child, which I think is a terrible thing to do, by the way, as a parent, and something I've been very determined not to do with my own children. So I think his view is, you know, I should never have written something that, I mean, he's never said this explicitly to me, but I think his view would be that I should never write anything that's at all reflecting badly on my parents. And I understand that. But I think he needs to understand that my experience on Wave Walker was a very different experience to his experience. And I have a right to tell my story as kind of truthfully as I can from my own perspective.
Why do you think you were denied an education? I imagine there were ways that you could have taken schoolwork with you or had some kind of structure thing, even if you're living on a boat. I know it's, you know, with the internet now and everything is different, but even then, yeah. Well, why do you think that was something that you didn't have the opportunity or access to, I should say?
So I think this really kind of came down to, again, my father's focus on the voyage and being a hero, and everything was in service of that. So he didn't really want anything happening that was going to be at all a hassle and stop him from doing, you know, pursuing his dream of being a hero. So when we first left England, my mother, who's actually a primary school teacher, took a bunch of worksheets with us and was supposed to be teaching us. And she did do that kind of a little bit, kind of very sporadically for the first kind of year or year and a half. Not very often, but occasionally. And then she stopped altogether. She said she couldn't really be bothered doing it anymore. She was too busy kind of working on the boat. And anyway, she taught us the stuff that she felt that she wanted to teach us. So then for a long time, I didn't get any schooling at all. And I was kept on saying to my parents I was desperate to go to school. And in fact, we have a really pivotal moment when we're in Hawaii, which is kind of the end of the voyage, because, or should have been the end of the voyage, because by that point we're 4 years in, 1 year delayed because of the accident. And that was where Captain Cook was killed. And that should have been the end point of the voyage. And we have a family vote. And I voted to come home to England, because I wanted to go back to school. And I wanted to see my friends. And I wanted to come back to my dog and my doll's house. And also, really importantly, my relationship with my mother was deteriorating as I became a kind of teenager or an adolescent. She was starting to not speak to me for days on end, and she would call me names and all sorts of other things. And so I wanted to be in a world where I could get away from that rather than being trapped on a boat. But my father overrode this vote. My brother and I both voted to come home. My father overrode us and said, no, he wanted to keep sailing. And I think that's because in the world of sailing on a boat, you can create this kind of image of yourself as being incredibly successful. You know, you're sailing a lovely boat in the Pacific. It all looks wonderful. And the reality of what it's like for the family can be concealed. You know, the fact that my mother was not very nice to me, the fact that I couldn't go to school, that we couldn't have friendships, that could all be concealed inside the boat. And so the external perception was, this is fantastic. You know, you're living a kind of dream life. Eventually we got to Australia, and I, by this time I'm kind of 13 or 14, I was allowed to go to school for a year or so there, which was wonderful, which was great. But then of course my father wanted to sail again, because when he's sailing again, he becomes a kind of hero when he can present this kind of version of himself to the world. I managed to convince my parents at that point to let me start doing correspondence, schooling by post. But it was incredibly difficult, because they really wanted me to work on the boat for several hours each day. There was no space on the boat to work. You can imagine we only had one table, which, given we had all these paying crew on board, there was very little space around the table. You're often at sea. It's very hard to study at sea. We're pre-internet, so there's no way of contacting my teachers. All I've got is kind of workbooks. And then what's most notable is my father is totally unwilling to compromise. So if my school papers were coming back to a post office, so I would send them off, say we got to Fiji, and I would send them back to the school in Australia, and then the school would send them back to Fiji, my father would never wait. You know, if they weren't there and he wanted to sail, he would sail. So the schooling was always secondary. And my mother, actually, for reasons I really don't understand, although I think she was slightly intimidated or threatened by me, actually started to try and disrupt my schooling, and, you know, would come in and turn on the radio and would try and get me to do chores when I was studying. Don't quite understand what was going on there, but I think she found me either kind of intimidating or threatening, or something was going on. But one way or another, I became obsessed with the idea that I was going to educate myself on this boat. And that was my route to freedom, because otherwise I was going to spend the rest of my life stuck on this boat, because there was no sign that my father was ever going to stop this voyage, which went on for year after year after year.
You know, as a kid or going into your teen years, having to think about things like that, right? That's like, how am I going to escape this situation? Essentially, that's what you had to do. That's what you had to think. And that's what you did. I mean, you managed it, which is incredible. We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Hey, you lovely listeners, Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter, and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast, and we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value, totally free. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show. Do you want to talk about how you finally sort of broke free from the whole situation? I know this is a process over many years, but you were able to educate yourself to a point, right? On your own. I mean, you must be incredibly self-motivated to kind of not let all these external circumstances get you down and still have the fortitude to, you know, read and learn and kind of pursue this mission of education. Not an easy thing to do.
Not an easy thing to do. And it is actually something I feel really passionate about. And one of the things that I've been doing on the back of the book coming out is I've been working with a whole bunch of charities that are trying to make sure that kids can get access to education. And I think it's really relevant to, you know, your podcast, which is about traveling, because I think if you're going to travel with kids, you need to do it in a way that doesn't disrupt their education. Because a lot of people have said to me, oh, but you get kind of education through the University of Life. To which I would say, okay, well, as somebody who actually experienced the University of Life, I'm afraid that just doesn't cut it. I mean, I wanted to be a scientist. You can't learn how to be a scientist stuck on a boat where all you've got is a bunch of secondhand books that my mother would trade in secondhand bookstores. I needed libraries. I needed laboratories. I wanted a teacher. I wanted to understand kind of, you know, what's inside water? You know, how do plants grow? You know, why is the sun hot? You know, what's inside the air? I wanted to know all these kind of facts, and to be able to learn that, I couldn't do it through the University of Life. I did learn a bunch of other stuff, which I think is very useful. You know, I learned a huge amount of resiliency. You know, I can sail a boat, I can build a mast, I can change the oil in an engine, I can, you know, knit, darn. I mean, all sorts of kind of skills that I have that I did learn through the University of Life. But that was never going to create for me the sort of career or to kind of answer the sort of questions that I had as a kid. And so I do think that as parents, we have an obligation to allow our children to get the education that they want, not the education that we think they want, but the education that they want and they need. Eventually, what happened with me was when I was 16 and my brother was 15, my parents became worried about my brother's education. As I said, it was a very gendered world. So one of the things my father at one point said to me was, it's very important that your brother gets an education because he will need to support a family when he grows up, whereas you will not. So they eventually became worried about his education. They put him into a school in New Zealand, and my father was supposed to stay with us to look after us. He had a job in New Zealand, actually, and my mother was going to keep sailing, to keep earning money by taking these paying crew on the boat. And then at the last minute, my father upped and left. And basically, they abandoned my brother and me in New Zealand. I'm 16, he's 15, and they don't come back for any more than a day or so here or there for almost 9 months. And that in the book is almost the most difficult period. I mean, the wave and the accident was the most physically dangerous. But that those 9 months in New Zealand, I knew no adults in New Zealand. I was basically on my own. I wasn't going to school. I was still trying to teach myself by post. And so I'm stuck in a little hut in New Zealand by Lake Rotuiti, which, by the way, is a very, very beautiful place, but incredibly isolated. I really kind of got to a point in that period where I ended up having a bit of a breakdown. I remember ringing up the New Zealand equivalent of Childline, which is called kind of Youthline, and having this bizarre conversation with this woman who said, well, where are your parents? And I said, well, they're on a boat somewhere in the South Pacific. And when are they coming back? And I said, well, I don't know. Well, can you contact them? Well, not really. They don't have a, you know, it's no way for me to ring them. I'm on my own. I'm basically on my own. But I kept studying through all of that. I mean, I was expected to kind of look after my brother, as always, kind of cooking and cleaning for him. So I did all of that. But I kept studying. I wrote to every university I'd ever heard of in the world, which is quite funny looking back, because I wrote to all of the very elite universities, basically because those were the only ones I'd ever heard of. Because even on a boat, even on a boat in the South Pacific, you've heard of Harvard University or Oxford University. But I had no way of knowing what the addresses were. So I wrote to Harvard University, Harvard America, and Oxford University, Oxford England, and Sydney University, and Auckland University, and so on. Most of them wrote back and said they wouldn't consider me because I had a British passport, so New Zealand wouldn't consider me and Australia wouldn't. I'm afraid Harvard never wrote back. I now know that Harvard University, Harvard America is not the right address, so I suspect they never got my letter. There you go. And incredibly,
their loss.
Their loss, Suzanne. Their loss.
Incredibly, London University wrote back and said that they wouldn't consider me because I was just too strange. But Oxford wrote back and said, write us a couple of essays, which I did. And I tried to make them quite strange topics because I thought otherwise there's no way that I'm going to be able to compete with somebody who's been in a normal education. So one of my essays was about doing science at sea because I figured, you know, that was a pretty, you know, pretty unique topic for me to write about. And then they invited me for an interview and they said, if you can get here for an interview, we'll interview you. So I went and picked kiwi fruit, which, by the way, is a pretty horrible job. I don't recommend it to anybody. They're horrible to pick. Nice to eat, horrible to pick. Earned enough money to get a plane ticket. My father made a small contribution. I got a one-way ticket and came back to the UK. And by that point, I'd been away for a decade. I hadn't been back to the UK, didn't know, you know, hadn't seen any of my relatives. And I had no plan B. I only had a one-way ticket to come back to the UK. But incredibly, I did this interview and they offered me a place. And that was the, you know, that was the start of the life that I've been able to create since, you know, really kind of going on with that.
And then you had to acclimate to this regular existence. How was that?
Well, there were two big problems. I mean, one was I assumed that having got this place, which was amazing, that socially this was going to be fantastic. After 10 years of not really being able to spend any time with people my own age, I was suddenly going to have friends, possibly boyfriends. I was going to be able to go to parties, all these things that I'd missed, all these normal things that a kind of teenager wants to do. I was suddenly going to be able to do. And then I was really worried about the academics because, you know, my schooling had so many holes in it. I'd never learnt my times tables. My pronunciation of words was really bizarre because most of the words I'd learnt, I'd read and not heard. And so I spoke in a really odd way. You know, common words I was okay on, but anything, you know, obscure. I mean, I remember on the boat, I thought that there were three types of measurement systems. There was pounds, there were kilograms, and then there were these other things called lillibulls. And it took years before I suddenly figured out that lillibulls were actually pounds. I mean, they were.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah, yeah, gotcha.
So I had all of these kind of odd things. What I found when I got to Oxford was actually academically, it was manageable, interestingly, because the one thing, and I guess I hadn't understood this, the one thing that I'd learned how to do in my childhood was to discipline myself and be self-motivated. So with access to a library, with access to lectures, I could fill in those gaps, or at least fill in those gaps enough. I worked hard. It wasn't straightforward, but that was okay. Unfortunately, socially, I found it much more difficult than I'd expected. I mean, just trying to kind of create friendships with people who'd had such a different background to me. My social skills, I think, were very limited. I didn't know how to do small talk. And of course, I just had nothing in common with people. And then the other issue that I had was I had very, very little money. My parents disowned me in my second term at university. They were always very, you know, very tight with money. And so
did they straight up say, we are disowning you? Is that because you left the boat?
They found an excuse to disown me, which was I couldn't go and pick up my brother from the airport when my brother came back to the UK. And that's because he was landing at a point where I was supposed to be on a field trip for my degree. And my tutor said that if I went and picked him up, I would disqualify myself from my degree. So I couldn't go and pick him up. So they used that as an excuse to disown me. I now know that they just lost the money. They had a small amount of money and they just lost it on the stock exchange in New Zealand. They disowned me kind of multiple times. But it basically meant that at Oxford I had no money because I didn't qualify for a grant because I'd lived out of the UK for 10 years. So I basically made do in Oxford for well over a year, pretty much by living on kind of packets of pasta. I would buy a big packet of pasta and some canned tomatoes, and that I could make do on for most of a week with a hazelnut yogurt on a Friday. And eventually it became desperate, and I went to my college and I kind of told them that I was poverty stricken. And it's very interesting. I went to my college recently, Somerville, who let me in, And they went back in their files and they found all these papers of when I had applied for a hardship grant. And what's interesting is in these papers, it says I didn't apply for a hardship grant for well over a year. I'd been kind of, it was well over a year after I was disowned when I applied for the grant. And I think that's because I was absolutely petrified that if they found out that I was poverty stricken, they were going to chuck me out. And I'd spent my entire life getting this place. I mean, that place to study meant more to me than anything else. But I think I got to the point where I was, you know, just destitute. I had no money whatsoever. And they were very kind. They gave me some meal tickets to eat in the hall, and they allowed me to stay in college rather than having to get a house outside. So one way or another, there's been various people in my life who have stepped in at key moments and really, really helped me. So I've been very lucky in that way.
Can you talk about some of those people on the journey or after the journey?
Yeah. So the really important people in my life, one is Mr. Ray. Mr. Ray is this wonderful character who, by the way, I'm still very close to now. He came on board as a crew member after the wave when we reached Australia. And he was on board for about 6 months. And the thing with Mr. Ray is the relationship that I had with him is the sort of relationship that you would imagine you would have with a wonderful father. I mean, he was funny. He liked spending time with me. We would sit on the bowsprit of the boat, which is the bit that sits at the very kind of front of the boat, kind of overhanging the water. And we'd watch the water and we'd watch the dolphins and the phosphorescence. And I just felt with Mr. Ray that I could do no wrong. You know, he just thought I was wonderful. And that was an experience that I never had with my parents. So he was really important. And what's really interesting is, although he was only on the boat for 6 months, my memory of Mr. Ray kept me going a long time. And that for me is quite interesting. I think a child, they don't necessarily need a lot of exposure to somebody who's kind to them for them to remember that. So Mr. Ray is a wonderful person. And he's actually come to some of my book events with me, which is great. He's having a great time, actually, because he's been asked to sign copies of the book. He was invited to his local Women's Institute event where they fed him cake. So, no, he's having quite a good time. He's one. My biology teacher at the correspondence school, a guy called Roger, who I never met in person at the time, was also incredible. When I was sitting in that hut in New Zealand on my own, he started sending me books. And he was really, really encouraging about going to university. And he was incredible. I mean, I don't think I would have got into university without him doing that. And what's really interesting about Roger is I went back to find him when I was writing the book, and I discovered that he had polio as a kid and, you know, is in a wheelchair or walks with a stick. I never knew that, you know, and that was why he was teaching at a correspondence school, not teaching in a normal school. And I owe him a lot. And actually, I felt a slight kind of pang of guilt that I never really asked about him as a teenager, because you don't. I was just so focused on trying to escape. And then the third person is my kind of tutor at Oxford, Marion Dawkins, who was Richard Dawkins' first wife, actually. And she was the one who made a bet on me. When I walked into that interview in Oxford and she saw somebody who... She's told me she saw somebody who was clearly very clever, you know, clearly very passionate about the subject, also had a very bizarre, patchy education. And she made a bet on me. She allowed me to come in. She effectively gave me a free pass, you know, despite the fact that I didn't meet all the entrance criteria, she gave me a free pass. And, you know, without her making that decision, you know, I don't know where I would have ended up.
You need those people that are willing to go the extra step to help somebody out. It's always a reminder when I hear those stories that it truly can make a difference. Those individual one-on-one words of encouragement or sending books we all have the opportunity to give that as well.
I agree. And it's not, you know, you can make a huge difference in somebody's life through what might seem to you to be a small intervention, you know. It might be I recently introduced, you know, an old colleague to another kind of friend of mine, as a result of which he's ended up with a job he didn't think he was going to get, because I just connected two people who I thought were really interesting. You can make a huge difference to people's life through small things that you do but you're, for whatever reason, in a position where you can do that. And I've always remembered it, you know. And it often, these are situations where the impact that you could have is massively disproportionate to the effort that it takes. And I think we should all be conscious of that, particularly those of us, myself now included, who are in a position to kind of help others.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good way to say it. Yeah. It could be a small thing. And, but that's always exciting about life, I feel. You know, you can have that type of impact. It's a nice thought, something certainly to keep in mind. The whole experience, I mean, how does it affect you now? How does it affect your parenting? How did it affect your parenting, raising children, your career? I'm sure you, especially with this book and talking about all this, you're probably thinking about this stuff more than ever. But
so it has affected, and it definitely has affected both my kind of parenting and my kind of career in both kind of positive and negative ways. I think with my parenting, I actually stopped, and I remember having the conversation with my sadly now late husband about how I wanted to be a parent, because I didn't really have a role model to be a parent. And I thought really quite deeply about what is it that a parent needs to provide to their children. And for me, it's about unconditional love, which I didn't have as a child. It's about, you know, providing for them all the things that I didn't have, you know, kind of safety and security and kind of a good education and stability and all of those sorts of things. It's about being there when they need you. And it's about, you know, kind of spending enough time and making them really feel that you kind of care about them. What's interesting, though, is I concluded quite early on, it wasn't about spending every day and every moment with them. I mean, my parents were with me the whole of my childhood, 24 hours a day, and they were not good parents to me. And in a funny sort of way, that was very liberating for me as a woman wanting to pursue a career, because I realized it wasn't about kind of being there every hour of every day. It was about being there a certain amount of time. It was certainly about being there when they needed me. It was certainly about unconditional love, but not about being there every hour of a day. So I was able to pursue my own career, and I always have. And then on the kind of work side, I think the positives are that I'm very resilient. And in fact, when I hit a crisis, I get very calm, partly because I'm able to put it into perspective. So if something happens, I can almost take myself back to being a little 7-year-old girl on that boat shipwrecked. And I can think, okay, this is tricky, but this is not like that. You know, this is, so I can put it in proportion, and that will calm me down. So those, I think, are real kind of strengths that come out of this. You know, my kids will say that there's also downsides as well. I mean, for example, I'm kind of notoriously unsympathetic about small injuries. So my children will kind of come having kind of cut their finger or something, and I'll look at it and go, you know, come on, you know. I was shipwrecked in the Indian Ocean and fractured my skull, you know, it's a small cut.
Right. Right.
So, you know, and then they do rather roll their eyes about the whole kind of, you know, will you eat your vegetables? You should be lucky having your vegetables. I grew up on kind of canned food and Spam. But I think, you know, for me, it's in both kind of a work context and a parenting context, it has been about being very deliberate about how I do it, particularly on the kind of parenting side, because I just didn't have that role model.
Was writing a thing for you on the book? I mean, did you find solace in writing?
I did. So quite early on, in fact, Mr. Ray, this crew member who came on board, used to keep a diary. And he told me that I should start to keep a diary. And that actually happened after an incident where we almost ran aground outside of Melbourne in Australia. And then after we almost ran aground, and that was quite a frightening kind of moment, as I describe in the book, my father, you know, afterwards kind of pretended it didn't happen. You know, he wouldn't talk about it. He, you know, basically tried to pretend, you know, it really, really didn't happen. And a similar thing was happening with the wave. Now, he couldn't pretend the wave hadn't happened and the accident, because that was so obvious. But I was not allowed to talk about it. So it was not a discussable topic. If I tried to talk about it, my father would say, we're not allowed to talk about it because it will upset your mother. So I lived in this world where things would happen and then they would be either ignored or, if they were slightly smaller, completely denied. And that does slightly crazy things with your head. Actually, even for a kid, that does slightly crazy things with your head. And I remember talking to Mr. Ray about it, and he had his diary, and he said, you need to keep a diary. And I was very little at that point. I was only 8 or 9, but I did start keeping a diary. The early diaries, I have to say, are kind of not particularly kind of useful, as you can imagine. But as time goes on, they become more and more and more detailed. And I kept a diary most of the way through my childhood on Wavewalker, which was incredibly helpful, as you can imagine, when I came to write the book, although I used lots of other documentation as well. And it was a solace. There is something about writing which enables you to, you know, order your thinking and put it down, and also go back to it and kind of look back at how you were feeling and kind of put things into perspective. So, you know, I really think it is a really helpful thing to be able to do.
Looking at the experience, it's hard to take a sweeping view of the experience and put a label on it. Is it like dealing with a trauma in a way? Is it something that you have to actively sort of deal with day to day, or do you talk to somebody about it, or are you kind of like, this part of my life's done, I've processed this. How do you view it in that way?
So after my husband died, he died in 2018. Lots of people said to me,
I'm so sorry for that.
It was very, very, very sad, but there wasn't anything we could do about it. After he died, lots of people said to me, you should do some therapy. And eventually, actually, in the middle of COVID, I did. I found that I could get some sessions of therapy on my medical insurance. And it's very interesting. This poor therapist, the first half of the first session we spent talking about my husband, which was very sad, but not complicated. You know, we both cared about each other. We did whatever we could. Unfortunately, it's just a great sadness that I have to deal with and have to help my kids as much as I can, kind of dealing with it as well. And then we got on to my parents. And that's just so much more complicated, because it's really hard to understand the decisions that they took and how they behaved. But I actually found talking to this therapist, and we ended up having, you know, as I say, kind of nine or 10 sessions, incredibly helpful. By that point, I'd actually already written the book, Wavewalker. It wasn't quite finished, but it was pretty close to being finished. And so I'd already processed quite a lot of it in my head. I had the story pretty clear. I knew what had happened. I knew how I'd kind of felt about it. But she was really good at asking me a few really good questions. One of them was, under what circumstances would you have a relationship with your father again? By that point, my father walked out on me in 2019, and I hadn't heard from him since. And so I ended up writing him a letter, and I said, you know, you don't need to explain to me what happened on Wavewalker, and I don't need you to apologize for it. But I just need you to acknowledge that this was what I experienced. Because by the way, I'm sure you experienced it in a different sort of way. I mean, you were up on deck, you know, sailing the boat. You were in control. This was your life. This was your dream. Your experience will be different to mine, but that was my experience. And that in a way was hugely kind of liberating as well, because I felt, okay, I've kind of told him now what the kind of terms would be, and I'm not being unreasonable. He obviously hasn't responded to that. I don't expect he will ever respond to it. But for me, it was really helpful to do that. So I would really strongly recommend to others, you know, if they've got a kind of childhood or indeed any sort of trauma, it was actually really difficult, really helpful to kind of talk it through. So that was really useful. So for me, the writing of the book, those sessions which I did were really helpful. And actually kind of talking about it since has been helpful. And so many people have come to me with somewhat similar childhoods, you know, either kind of parents who are somewhat similar to mine, or, as I say, I've had a whole series of kind of kids who've grown up with very extreme travel experiences, which haven't always been very positive. And it's been really helpful talking to them as well.
Was the book something you felt like you just had to write for yourself? Like, even if one person bought it, was it something you were going to write regardless?
Yeah, absolutely. I always knew I was going to write Wavewalker. I mean, it was a book I knew I was going to write from almost, almost kind of being a teenager. I always knew I was going to write this book. The real question for me, and it wasn't about lots of people reading it, it was about me wanting to tell. I mean, every so often, you know, life just gives you a story that if you have any inclination to write, you've just got to write that story. You know, and it's less about who reads it. It's about, you know, it's about writing a kind of story that you just feel that you need to write. The real issue for me was, at what point do I write it? Because I know when I write it, I'll blow up this relationship with my parents. And I had to wait until I got to a moment where I realized that that relationship with my parents, which was very superficial, was much less important than actually telling the story. And my, you know, I also got to a point where my ability to understand why they've made those decisions became much, you know, well, I had kind of kids of my own of a similar sort of age, and I could just no longer understand their decisions. And that made me kind of free to write about it. So, yes, I always knew I was going to write it. It was just a question of when was I going to write it?
Yeah, I guess to kind of take what you've learned and just share, whether it's somebody listening who has kids or has a spouse or a friend or somebody they're considering going on a big adventure with. What would be your advice for creating a space to have that conversation where kind of get everybody's feedback and on board and or not on board, or, you know, just get everybody's honest take on it? And that's an evolving thing. I feel like, you know, you might set out on something for 3 months and then people's feelings change and they want to go home. Or like you had the family vote at that one point, which didn't sound like it was much of a democratic vote because your wishes were ignored. Yeah, going back to kind of where we started with this idea of respecting the needs of the little ones versus the parents' dream, or perhaps it's a couple or somebody else. Just would love your thoughts on that.
Yeah. So I think if I take the kind of kids bit first, I think if you're going traveling with small kids who really can't articulate what they need. So I think you have a responsibility as a parent to think about their needs for them. And kids do need, and I think we kind of have an obligation as parents to give them education, a certain amount of socialization, which is really important and becomes increasingly important over time. And then, you know, you've got to do it in a safe way. They've got to have access to kind of medical care and dental care and kind of food and water and all of the other things. So there's a kind of certain physical safety of it. And then you've got the education bit and you've got the socialization bit. Now, the easy way to do that is you kind of do it in school vacations. But if you want to do something more extreme, you do have to craft something that involves either, you know, proper homeschooling or, you know, some sort of correspondence schooling or something else. But it has to be a priority because you're making decisions that could change your kid's life. And people often ask me about, by the way, homeschooling, and I think that can work. I think the danger of it is that if you have a dysfunctional family, it can be hidden within that structure. And I think we all need to be aware of that, that it can work very well in a very functional family, but it can often be very hard for a child to call out if there's a problem because they don't have anyone to go to. You know, if you're outside of a schooling system, you don't have a teacher to go to. You know, you don't have anybody else to go to if the family becomes dysfunctional. Now, I then think it's very different when you get an older child who can, you know, who can articulate their needs. And then I think as a parent, you have an obligation to listen to them. You know, they're now becoming a, you know, they're becoming an adult person or growing into becoming an adult person of their own. And children will react in different ways. You may have a child who loves the extreme adventure, you know, does not, you know, is not that kind of academically inclined. You still have an obligation to make sure that they have an education. But, you know, the needs of that child may be very different to a very kind of academic child who doesn't enjoy the extreme adventure. I think you need to listen to them and respect their views because they have a right to express those views, and what the family does has to be a balance of what the parents need and what the children need. I'm not arguing that the children should dictate what the parents do, but there has to be a balance between the two. And then if you're talking about two adults, I think it's really very different because with two adults, you have two people who can articulate their views and, you know, hopefully they're talking about the kind of the needs that each of them have and what they each want to do, and they can find a compromise. And I'm less concerned about that. I think if somebody wants to go off solo traveling and do something incredibly extreme, or if they want to go with a partner or indeed a group of adults, that I feel much more comfortable with. You know, they're making decisions, they're adults, they know what the consequences are. I think it's very different when you're taking a child, because a small child can't articulate their needs, and even a kind of teenager, they're incredibly dependent on you. You know, and this is one of the things that I kind of realized looking back and also kind of talking to this therapist, is it's very hard for a child, even a teenager, to take on their parents in a fundamental way and to break out of the world their parents create, because they don't have an alternative world. You know, they don't have anywhere else to go, really. And also, kind of, what are you doing if you pull down the world your parents have created? I mean, that is your only universe. Whereas for me, when I became old enough, I was able to go back and talk about it much more honestly. But now I've created my own world with my own family and my own kids and my kind of wider friends and everything else.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Thanks for that. That's great advice and super meaningful coming from you, given everything you've been through. Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's coming into the teen years and thinking about how you almost need to give them the support to create their own new universe outside of the parents' universe or whatever the case is. Wow. I mean, you must have kept a pretty incredible diary, because it's very detailed with the conversations, and it's super compelling. So if people are listening and they want to hear the full story, of course, the book will link to it all, Wave Walker Breaking Free, your website, SuzanneHaywood.com. Assume they can find all the things over there. Would that be the best place to go?
Yeah, so I think the book is widely available, kind of Wave Walker, and some people like it. It's on kind of Audible and Kindle as well. I ended up reading it on Audible, which was great, actually, because you will have to excuse a bit of my pronunciation here and there, but I think it's nice to have it kind of read by the author. As you said, yeah, I have a kind of website as well, which they can have a look at, and there's various podcasts and so on around. But I really hope that people either read or listen to the book, because it's only by doing that that you actually go on the journey. And I've deliberately written it as I experienced it. So as you read it, you can come to your own conclusions about, you know, what were my parents doing? You know, what was happening to me? And you can also see, because it goes on over 10 years, my perspective on it changes quite considerably. You know, to start with, this is all the big adventure. And then by the time I'm a 16, 17-year-old, I'm feeling in a very different way. And you kind of have to live through that journey to get that. So I really hope that people get the chance either to kind of read it or listen to it. And I'm really excited to hear what people think about it.
Congratulations on it. You know, it's one thing to have the intention to write about the experience and then to pull it off so incredibly. Have all of your kids read it? Do you know if they've read the book?
So two of my kids have read it. One of them has not, because it's very interesting, isn't it? Kind of my kids are wonderful, but they all now have their own lives. This is back to this point about, you know, as you become an older teenager, my kids are now in their kind of early 20s. They're busy creating their own lives with their own friends. You know, they're off at university. One of them has started a job. So they've been incredibly supportive of me writing the book and everything around it. But it's also a tiny fraction of their lives. You know, their lives are about kind of creating their own worlds now. So in a funny sort of way, I think that's kind of great. You know, I don't want them to be spending a lot of time thinking about it. I do occasionally wonder what I would have to do to get my kids' attention. You know, I'd probably have to kind of skydive off the Eiffel Tower or something. Right. And they might kind of go, oh, yes.
Well, I understand that. But I mean, there is something pretty special about being able to really submerge yourself into one of your parents' childhood experiences in that way, like their childhood experience. And you know, it's not an opportunity that every kid has to pick up a memoir that their parent wrote and to really understand what they went through and where they came from, which of course can't help but impact some of the things you experienced growing up.
I think that's right. And I think also as you become a little bit older, I think they will spend more time kind of going back and thinking about it. I also wrote a memoir of my late husband, who was a very senior civil servant here in the UK, worked for four different prime ministers. And that's there as well, kind of what does Jeremy think it was called? That's there as well for them to kind of go back to. And I think they will more kind of over time. They're in that phase of their lives, which I'm kind of delighted in a way that they are, where they're busy establishing themselves and their kind of career and their friendships and everything else. But all of this is there for them to experience. And of course, they've heard so much about Wade Walker kind of growing up. You know, it's kind of there and around us. You know, I have the compass from Wade Walker in our house. So it is very much kind of part of their lives, even though they've kind of grown up in a very, very different sort of way.
Yeah, it's a gift that will be there waiting for them whenever
exactly.
they need it.
Exactly.
Yeah, because you went and got the compass. You went to look for the boat again, right?
I did. I felt this kind of great need to go back and try to find out what had happened to Wade Walker. My parents wouldn't tell me what had happened to her. And I went, and it's like a kind of bonus chapter at the end of the book. I went back to try and track her down in Fiji. It was an extraordinary kind of almost like a Miss Marple detective story, kind of, you know, going around in kind of Fiji in a little kind of pink car trying to work out what happened to her. And I eventually got hold of her compass. But I've never found out actually what happened to Wade Walker herself. So it's one of those slightly unsolved mysteries. And I'm hoping at some point somebody will work it out.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for doing this.
Thank you very much. It's been lots of fun.
It's been such a pleasure. And we're happy to spread the word about the book and hope we can stay in touch. Thanks again.
No problem.
Thanks once again to Suzanne Haywood for stopping by the show. Of course, her website, suzannehaywood.com. The memoir again, Wade Walker, Breaking Free. It must be tough to talk about that stuff. And that's what you sign up for, I guess, when you write a memoir. But at the same time, having to relive some traumatic events and things that happened in your life that maybe still stick with you in many ways can't be easy all the time. So I just appreciate her time, her vulnerability. And I think one of the big lessons coming out of this here, of course, that importance of considering the needs of your travel companions to balance the needs of everybody involved. Again, as I said on the front end, this may be an extreme example, a cautionary tale, if you will, but it does bring up the question of when you're traveling, you're planning trips with a spouse or friends or children. Yeah, to just be tuned in to each other and each other's needs. And it was really a great reminder for me to kind of make sure I check in with my kids as I go about planning future adventures and things like that. And I think that's just an important thing to keep in mind. The other thing I wanted to bring up from this interview that I found really inspiring and important and another great reminder was that quote I shared, that clip I shared at the beginning where Suzanne was talking about the teacher that made a huge difference in her life and how you can make a huge difference in people's lives, even with a small intervention or a small thing that you do. And that is empowering everybody listening here right now, you, me, everybody else that's a part of this wonderful listening community. We all have that ability as humans to step in. It doesn't have to be. I feel like sometimes we think that we have to have these grand gestures in order to make a difference. And it has to be this big impact on this huge scale. When in actuality, we can do these small things that make a big difference in somebody's life. That might be even just taking the time to let them know something. You know, sometimes somebody says something to you at the right time and you just, it just like, wow, they noticed that about me. They see something in me that really gives me confidence to move forward. And I think we've all had this experience in our lives where maybe somebody's said a compliment to us or patted us on the back about something we did. Maybe we got some praise that we don't normally get. Maybe, you know, somebody helped us out on the road in some way, whatever the case is, something's probably coming to mind for you. And how that had a big impact, much bigger impact than probably that person thought. And also the effort that it probably took was very minimal for that person, but made a big difference in your life. And I just wanted to bring this up as we wrap this up, because we're all in the position to make that impact with others. And perhaps it's worth meditating on that today, thinking about how you could be that difference maker and doing it in a way that doesn't really require a lot of you. Something to think about anyway. I just wanted to throw this out there because that part of this conversation stuck with me, and I feel like if I share these types of things in the podcast, perhaps it will have a ripple effect. You know, who knows? But I thought it was worth sharing and pointing out. So there you go. I also want to leave you with a quote to wrap this up. And I said at the top, this quote summarizes one of the big themes of this conversation. And to me, I'm putting the focus back on our guest and her resilience. Resilience was one thing that stuck with me, perseverance. And this quote is from Nelson Mandela, who said, "Do not judge me by my success. Judge me by how many times I fell down, got back up again." I'll leave you with that one. Don't forget zerototravel.com/newsletter. Keep in touch off the pod. It's free. Sign up over there if you haven't done so yet. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Peace and love to you and yours. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by zerototravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.